So I wanted to talk a little bit, have us do some practice together, and really open up the floor for your questions and comments. When anyone asked me for a title, I went back to what, in some ways for me, are fundamentals, and went to the force of kindness. And as you all know, I'm sure, I first began practicing meditation in January of 1971, so it's been a good long time. And I'm sort of in a mode, I've noticed, in my own process where I feel like going back to the beginning of many things. The first thing I did when I entered my first intensive 10-day retreat, which was the first time I ever meditated at all, was to take refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha. And in a way, that could be seen as the earliest laying of context and something in a way to leave behind as one moves deeper and further into the past. But then I was thinking, well, you know, that's the very first thing I did in becoming engaged in a very real way with these practices. And I thought, I bet if I really understood that, that would be enough. You know, that if I really understood that very first thing I did, which was the taking of refuge, it wouldn't be seen as preliminary or just laying a context or something a little simple or to be gone beyond in any way. It probably would seem like the culmination of the entire path. And I'm thinking that about many things. I'm finding myself going back to some of the first techniques that I ever used, like just sitting down and feeling my breath or even counting my breath. And seeing that, oh, they didn't have to be regarded as preliminary or stepping stones in any way. They can be seen as the fulfillment of a path as I bring everything I've learned in all of these many years. And it's just that way for me in terms of kindness or loving kindness or compassion. In many contexts, the idea of kindness or loving kindness, many contexts within Buddhism even, it's seen as, well, it's a relative practice. It's something that is really nice to create a kind of space or an environment within which one can then go on and deeply explore emptiness and so on. And, of course, there's a lot of truth to that. But I also see it as a tremendous expression of the fulfillment of the path. And in some ways, it's another one of those movements that is not linear. You know, we don't start out developing a little bit of kindness, say, toward ourselves, only in order to be able to see more clearly, so that we can understand and develop insight, but because that is also, that kindness is also the ultimate expression of a very deep understanding of emptiness and the nature of reality and seeing things as they are. And so the beginnings and the ends are kind of blending for me in many ways. And I'm particularly drawn to this idea of kindness because it is so sort of put down in a way in our society, in our culture. It can so easily be seen as something kind of goody-goody and superficial almost, like it, or at least one-dimensional, that it has one face, it has one manifestation, and it's soft and it's nice and it's sweet, but it's not necessarily very strong. And I can remember teaching one loving kindness retreat in Barrie, and I had a friend sitting in the retreat who's sort of a rebellious type, and she likes to think of herself as somebody who marches to the beat of her own drummer and is radical and tests things and doesn't take things for granted and is independent and sort of bold. And I remember she came up to me at the end of the retreat and she said, "Now I get it. If you really want to be a rebel, be kind. You know, if you really want to break away from the sort of narcissistic expectations of society and do things in a bold, courageous, audacious way, be kind." And I loved that. You know, I thought, oh, yeah, isn't that true? In so many ways, but it's a kindness that has not only so many modes of expression, but I think it really has so many dimensions. There's so many varying things that make up that face of kindness, or that really it's intricate. All the different layers and subtleties and nuances of what we call kindness is composed of. I recently spent some time with a friend of mine whose name is Teresa McGee, who's running this program at the Garrison Institute called Transforming Trauma, which also happens to be the title of a book she wrote. She wrote a book called Transforming Trauma, A Path Toward Wholeness. And she was talking about how in traumatic experience, there is this tremendous rupture. It's like a break with the fabric of the whole, and our sense of meaning is assaulted, and our vision of what human beings can do or nature can do or who we are just crumbles, and it's so overwhelming. And the most corrosive component of that trauma, whatever the cause was, is generally speaking a sense of isolation, that we have become disconnected and set apart because of the severity of our own pain, our heartbreak. And, so Teresa was saying that it's believed that one of the most powerful healing agents in trying to help people through traumatic experience is what's called being a compassionate witness. That if one has a compassionate witness to hear one's story, to witness our pain, to be present through that telling, even if they can't fix it, even if there's not a kind of agency to really alleviate the causes of that suffering, then there is a healing, because we don't feel so alone and we don't feel so cut off. And so the isolation component of that pain or trauma is what recedes, and many things then become possible. And when she was saying that, I thought, as I often do, about the internal mechanism of meditation practice, and how in many ways one could say through mindfulness, for example, that we are becoming our own compassionate witness to pleasure, to pain, to neutral experience, all that we go through. And it's not to say that it obviates the need for someone external, you know, to bear witness. But it's a tremendous thing that we can do for ourselves to have a particular relationship to the narrative, the story, the recounting, the experience that we go through as we go deep within, the many experiences that we go through as we go deep within. So to be a compassionate witness, I think, implies many things. And if we're, you know, taking the example of being that for oneself, then it is very much what we would call mindfulness, which means a lot of things. It means, first of all, that there is a kind of witnessing, which means that we're not swept up or sucked in or overcome or defined by the experience that we're witnessing, whether it's the emotional state or the story or whatever it might be, that we can be present with our experience without being totally submerged in it. And it also means that we are not hostile to it. We're not rejecting it. We're not ashamed. We're not trying to push it away or call it something else, that we can actually be present fully. So it's connected but spacious and open. It also implies a kind of vitality of connection where there's a fullness, there's a complete presence in that noticing and that awareness that's also very strong. And there is the compassionate part, which is a particular mechanism of response. I like to think, and I think the research is starting to bear this out, although it's kind of preliminary, But as I think about compassion in this sense, I think of it as somewhat different from empathy, although, of course, very connected. As I've heard social psychologists talk about it, or neuroscientists talk about it, they seem to trace a path, and I tend, in my mind, to bring it another step. And the path begins with attention. It's actually noticing one's own pain, or noticing the pain of somebody else, noticing the situation of somebody else, not being cut off, not being oblivious, not looking the other way, not being distracted, not being deluded, but actually being aware. And if we are aware, if we're attentive, then we experience our pain as pain, not as bad or wrong or terrible, whether that pain is manifesting as anger or greed or physical pain or whatever it might be. We can recognize it as suffering. And so, too, when we look at someone else, we have that kind of empathetic resonance. We see, oh, yeah, I know what that feels like in a way. It registers in our own body. We have that almost like a kind of sympathetic resonance as we see, oh, yeah, I know what that feels like. And in many ways, that kind of tenderness or that empathy is often considered the root of morality, very natural morality or ethics, where it's not so much a question of following guidelines or the superimposition of certain rules, but it's like our heart just knows how it would feel like. For example, if we're about to tell a lie to somebody because it would be awfully easy, maybe a lot easier than speaking the truth, or finding a way to speak the truth, there's a moment usually when we remember, oh, I know what it feels like when someone lied to me. There's that sense of being disregarded or overlooked or not trusted or almost annihilated sometimes. And knowing what that felt like, we don't want to do that to somebody else. And so we pull back from what might have seemed like an easy solution to our dilemma, which would be to tell the lie. We don't want to make someone else feel that particular way. And so empathy is really a tremendous thing. But I do make the distinction between empathy and compassion because I think that we might feel someone else's painful situation. It might register in our bodies. We might recognize it. And that might frighten us. You know, we might not have a compassionate response to that felt pain. We might want to run away. We might feel overcome. We might feel repulsed. We might be so frightened that, you know, we can't run away fast enough. And I think that while empathy and compassion are certainly connected, that compassion is a very particular response to the experience, the open acknowledgement of pain, whether our own or someone else's. So to be a compassionate witness, I think, means to be fully present, aware, connected, sensitive, to feel that kind of empathy, and to have a response of presence, of caring, of sufficiency, not being overcome, not being broken by it, not being frightened by it, but almost acting from a place of wholeness in that response. So sometimes I use the example of, you know, if I were to go, I suppose one could say to a therapist, in my case, would likely say be a meditation teacher. You know, if I were to go to a therapist or a teacher and really be expressing a lot of pain in a certain situation, there is a place of response that I am actually seeking. You know, if they're cold, if they're demeaning, if they're kind of saying, it's no big deal, you know, what are you so upset for? Something like that, I would feel diminished, I would feel put down, misunderstood. I wouldn't know where to put the pain. It's like there's no one to help me hold it. in a way. On the other hand, if I were to go to somebody like that seeking help and told them the story and expressed my pain and they, you know, fell down on the floor sobbing, I would not be very happy either. I would probably be quite scared by that. Like, there's no way out. This is so bad, you know, that they can't even imagine a repair, you know, a healing that, whoops, I'm really in a bad way. This is, you know, this is awful. You know, what we want in that situation is the care, the tenderness, the real connection, the compassion about our pain, and we want some mirroring of a possibility, either for change, for wholeness, for a bigger perspective, for seeing through some sense of the universality of this situation, that it's not just my own, that it's the nature of things, something that helps me emerge into a bigger picture of life. And that's really what we all want. And so I think compassionate witnessing has all of those elements. And, you know, we're all called upon to do that in some way with ourselves and with others in varying degrees of difficulty, whether it's from, you know, disappointment to embarrassment, to something much graver. When we enter that space of being present and caring, but not being defined by the circumstance, then we are offering this tremendous gift of kindness, because it's not just, it's not, in a way, it's not like a dualistic kindness. It's not like saying, I am really intact and fine, you know, and I'm taking care of you, who are sort of a mess, and, you know, gonna just sort of make you feel better because I am really fine, and not only will you feel a little better, but my fineness will be reinforced, and I'll feel even further away from you because I will just be experiencing so much delight. Together I am, you know, it's not an act of separateness. In some ways, it's both admitting our shared vulnerability to change and to loss and not getting what we want, and it's also together touching something that is not defined by the body. It's not defined by the things that pull us apart. But it is about this sense of possibility, which in the best understanding of who we are, is something that we definitely share, and all beings share. And so we enter something that is much bigger than any one of us when we can affirm that sense of possibility. And maybe before we practice together, I'll just close with a little bit about this work that someone has done on self-compassion, because I think it's a very interesting expression of this kind of witnessing. The idea of self-compassion is that it's not really the same thing as self-esteem. Self-esteem, also a good thing, you know, really refers to our sense of self-worth or how much we like ourselves. And, in Western culture, this sense of self-esteem is often based on how distinctive we are, how special we are, how much we stand out, or, you know, if we feel that we're kind of average or ordinary or like everybody else, that doesn't lead to a great sense of self-esteem. But in contrast to that, self-compassion isn't based on a kind of evaluation But it's the understanding that all beings deserve compassion and understanding, not because of having a certain trait, like being special or especially smart or talented or something like that. But it is based on that kind of universality of understanding that we all do share both that possibility for happiness and this tremendous vulnerability that allows us to reach out or help or be kind, not from a place of being immune, but of recognizing how much we share. And so it's Kristen Neff who developed this scale and this research vehicle on self-compassion, and I think it's really worth thinking about for a few moments, just because of course, the other thing about kindness is that we tend to think about the other mostly. You know, we don't often think about kindness toward ourselves. And it's almost embarrassing in a way. You know, I've often said, because people say over and over and over again, well, I can't meditate. You know, I can't take the time away. It's really selfish. I can't do that. And I often say it's quite ironic, you know, that we, if somebody says to any one of us, you know, there's this thing you can do, and it's going to take you about 20 minutes a day, and it will really, really help your friend, we'd probably do it, you know, it wouldn't be much hesitation. But if it's like, there's this thing you can do, and it's going to take you about 20 minutes a day, and it'll really, really help you, that's tough. That's very, very tough. You know, we think that's not right in some way. But, of course, helping ourselves ultimately is helping all that we encounter and hopefully ultimately helping all beings. So why don't we meditate together for a few minutes with this sense of kindness. You know, whether you're settling your attention on the feeling of the breath, whether you're noticing that you're very distracted, and your attention's just wandering all over the place, and you have to gently let go and begin again. Let this kind of compassionate witnessing, seeing what is in a spacious yet connected way, be your touchstone. So if you like, you can just sit comfortably, close your eyes, unless you're driving. Let your attention settle into your body, onto your breath, and pay particular attention to those moments when you do need to let go of a distracting thought or feeling. And the possibility of kindness in that moment as you simply return. Remember, no matter how many times you have to let go and begin again, it's fine. When you feel ready, you can open your eyes.